It is a great pleasure for my latest Nostalgia interview to meet David Cloak. And David, of course, you are, whether you will consider yourself this, a professional radio DJ, the very kind that all my life, of course, I've loved listening to.
Well, clearly you got the check before before we started this interview. Ex-pro, but I would say a highly enthusiastic amateur these days. So with working in community radio rather than doing it for a living.
Yeah, because we've met, of course, at Cabin FM, where I've been based for the last 13 or so weeks. Yeah. But, I mean, how did the journey start for you? Because we were talking as we were walking over here to do the interview, that, you know, once upon a time, in a very analogue world, and of course very apt because you present a programme called The Analogue Years, but there was a very different sort of way of understanding what the role of a radio presenter was. I used to go to Radio 1 roadshows, that kind of thing, and there was a sense that normally you'd be lucky to catch them in person maybe once a year. They were studio bound, we didn't have social media, a different world.
It's changed enormously since my days, and bearing in mind when I got into radio was the sort of late 80s, early 90s, and it was very much independent local radio. So the IBA, as it was known way back when, replaced by the Radio Authority, would commission contractors to fulfil licences, similar to what we do at Cabin FM, but on a community basis. And there obviously wasn't the digital platforms and services that you have now. And as a result, it wasn't necessarily a closed shop, but it was a very different way of engaging as a new presenter with radio stations. And the classic way that, you know, I got into radio was twofold. One, actually being a bit of a nuisance, and with people at the local hospital radio station I was volunteering at, Hospital Radio Crawley in West Sussex. A guy I can't thank enough called Gary Hornbuckle, who became chief engineer at Southern Sound, as it was. He saw that I had a bit of skill behind a desk. As in a radio desk rather than just an office desk. And he invited me to be a technical operator and to be trained, which was really, really great. So that was putting in the adverts and jingles for pre-recorded shows, as well as driving the desk and the output for outside broadcasts, which I did for a couple of years very, very happily at Southern Sound. But I always wanted to be that radio presenter, and actually have the option of lifting the mic channel and doing what I do now. So from that, I met some really terrific people, and one which is a guy called Steve Power, who's still going on Nation Radio. He was at Wave 105 for many years and part of Chiltern Radio for a number of years. A terrific guy. And I got very, very pally with him, and he's still a very, very good mate. And I got lots of great advice from him and other presenters, in particular a guy so sadly not with us anymore, Richard Gwynn, and also Chris Copsey, who's sadly no with us. Sussex is, I think, most able and brilliant local radio presenter. And they gave me some really good advice. So I actually had to change my accent and change my approach to how I present. And I went through elocution lessons. And that paid a lot of dividends, because I got my first break on a satellite radio station called Radio Nova International, that was kind of a spin-off from the old Dublin part radio station, but it was legalised and on the old Astra 1 satellite. So we were on some obscure channel, on some obscure audio carrier channel during the day in mono, but it was a great chance to sort of ply your wares. And then knowing Steve, knowing also the late Paul Chandler at Chiltern Radio, he was programme director, program controller. I got my first full-time gig at Northants Radio on drive time. And then it sort of went from there. And I sort of stuck with the Chiltern Radio Network for a number of years there, and most notably at Seven Sound in Gloucester, before the sort of the big changes in radio ownership, which sort of eventually kind of leads us to where we are with Bayer and Global. So my route was quite a traditional route for them, but the overall operating environment and, you know, down to, you know, what radio is about, I think, has really changed over the years.
Because I remember going to see Johnny Walker at the Gulbenkian in Canterbury when he was promoting his book, got a signed copy. That would have been 2009. And somebody in the audience asked him, if I want to get into radio today, what do I need to do? And he thought about it for a moment. He said, well, and he wasn't saying this in a good way, but he said, well, you need a TV show. And a few people laughed. He said, because these days, you know, radio is, I mean, there was a time when the radio presenters were the personalities themselves. These days, you've got the presenters who don't drive the desk. And they have someone do it for them. And they are TV personalities. And they bring their TV persona onto radio. And Paul Gambaccini, I think, has similar kind of feelings. And there is that sense that, you know, radio for me was always the thing in itself. It was never a sort of a side gig. You know, when you're not on TV, you're doing your radio show. The radio would always take preeminence. And I guess you witnessed that shift because it would have been around that period, 90s into the noughties, when there was a shift, as you say, and the local stations became big because they were owned by big names.
Yeah, absolutely. And growing names. So if you look at the journey of, say, for example, Chiltern Radio, which had six stations. I mean, it launched Galaxy Radio as well, the regional Wales and South West licensed dance music station. You know, for whatever business, you know, processes or powers or influence, there were bigger fish that were looking to swallow up groups like Chiltern, and GWR was one of them. And fair play to GWR, they went down a very, very single kind of business narrative in terms of what their offer was, which was a very populist offer. And, you know, they sweep the board. If you look at Capital, they were doing a similar thing. They took on Southern Sound, as it was, Southern FM, Invicta, Ocean, Power FM in Hampshire, Oxfordshire's Fox FM. You know, they were growing. So it was inevitable that, you know, a cornerstone of Global, what Global is today, you know, was the amalgamation of Capital and GWR for GCAP, and, you know, and the story goes on. Part of that has been deregulisation. And I think that's the most noted thing, as a key cornerstone of change, has been the ability to own more radio licences. There was a short spell where radio licence owners couldn't just do network programmes, which I know that there is some regulation in place, particularly like Great Six Radio and the old Wave 105 frequencies. So they've still got some local presentation, as is the same at a number of other different stations that have kind of a national name and a national reach. But deregulisation enabled ownership to be much more business-like and a little bit more sort of, you know, capitalist in terms of, well, you know, there are smaller radio stations, so if they want to sell out, yes, you know, why should we stop that from happening? So I think that's the one cornerstone. The other thing is the revolution in digital technology and the different platforms and radio on demand, podcast on demand, the reach of every single radio station, including our own Cabin FM in Herne Bay, to have a, you know, the potential for global audience.
Yeah, and I found that because, and a confession, I was living in Herne Bay 2017, even though I went to the Cavanagh, and even in those days, of course, the cinema was playing Cabin's music. I didn't click. You know, I didn't realise that there was this brilliant radio station, which, of course, I now listen to. I mean, I was a Radio 2 listener. I still am. But Cabin does exactly the sort of thing, not least, obviously, I'm on the team. And I was kind of surprised because this happened with a lot of the BBC stations as well, with local services, a recognition that you've got all these BBC local stations across the country and they're all doing what they do brilliantly for their small communities, but the reach is very small, so they brought them all together, so they've conglomerated. And you find that as well with some of the stations. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can listen to Cabin overseas, that's great, but also you've got some of the stations like Smooth, which, you know, you have Smooth South or Smooth London or North, but really they're just versions of the same thing. And there are pluses and minuses in that. There's a bigger reach. You've got, it's going to entice the more sort of personalities there, but at the cost of that local element, which was exactly why they were set up in the first place.
Yeah, but and I think, you know, in my view, sort of reflecting on those changes, is that such a bad thing? And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but is that such a bad thing, or is that just purely evolution? Because not only are you seeing the geographical dynamics, or have seen the geographical dynamics totally change over the last 20, 30 years when it comes to radio, but you've also seen format change. So why don't you offer a soul station? Why don't you offer a classical station? And I know that, Classic FM and the like, and Magic have a particular format that they have agreed to deliver. But why not expand on a theme? The key difference is about the financial dynamics as well. At the end of the day, radio, if it isn't the BBC, it is commercial. So they need to obviously earn their corn somehow. But I shouldn't really say this, but I will do it. Even though we belong to a wonderful community radio station, Cavern FM. Is community radio filling the old ILR gap? I think that's quite debatable. Is community radio doing a fantastic job in the main? Absolutely, because it's getting people like you and me either back interested in it or providing an outlet, and it's providing a community service which we hold very, very dear in terms of our own local area.
The irony in that, of course, is that, and I found this, and this is a confession because I do live radio, and of course I'm always keen to get the listeners to contact the show and to get some sort of feedback, particularly as you're doing all the local listings, so there's a real community element. Without exception, the only people who've contacted the show tend to be people known to me. Now, the other presenters have said the same thing, and I guess, looking back, I've been an avid radio listener for over 40 years, since I was very young. But how often in that time have I ever contacted a radio show? And that's interesting. I'm a listener. I don't tend to contact a programme. I'm somebody who will listen to the callers on Jeremy Vine, or I'll listen to all the sort of the phone-ins, but would never even contact picking up the phone. So I accept that there may be people who are listening and fascinated, but are just not going to get involved. So I'm pushing them to do something that I myself wouldn't do. But the ironic thing is, the people who are listening and the people whose dedications or shout-outs or whatever it is are on air may even be overseas. So it's a community station, but I'm reading requests from people who are not even remotely covered by 94.6.
That's the benefit, and I will say benefit, of the online platform, whether it be the app, whether it be through the website or through, apps like TuneIn and the like. That's great. So is that such a bad thing? The importance, I think, for community radio is to retain the responsibility for the local community. Cabin FM, we're hoping, will be on a digital radio platform, DAB Plus, within the next couple of years. The responsibility is still to Herne Bay, and that's the important thing, because that's our commitment, both as a charity. And most community radio stations are at heart charities and are charitable objects, but also the requirements under the Ofcom licensing agreement. So there is still, regardless of how far in the universe you transmit and people are listening on Mars or whatever, there is still that absolute need to have community radio focused on the community it serves, which, again, I pay tribute to Sheppey FM. I mean, they do an extraordinary job, and they have a very, very different approach, because they are much more linked to community voluntary services, and they're a radio station attached to that, whereas we're a radio station for Herne Bay that supports the various kind of broadcast, local broadcast needs and opportunities for Herne Bay, rather than being sort of part of that sort of social charitable service kind of approach. So the responsibility is still there, and I just hope that community radio doesn't lose sight of that.
Yeah. Now, when you started the journey, and you've mentioned that in that sense, it was almost accidental, in the sense that you were in a studio and somebody thought, you've got this ability to do this, and it ended up with an online presence. But what was the goal for you when you were starting out? Did you imagine, because you've obviously got a great radio voice, elocution lessons or otherwise.
Oh, darling, thank
you.
Splendid.
But did people say to you, I met up with some old school friends last week, and some of them are surprised that I'm doing radio, but many of them were like, yeah, but we always knew that what you wanted to do. You went into a different career, great, but it wasn't what we imagined that you would do, but that's life. What did you think you'd be doing?
Presenting. I just wanted to be a radio presenter. At the age of 14, 15, I remember coming down to my mother one morning in a half term or whatever and just saying, oh, I'd like to go into hospital radio. And I don't know where it came from. I have no idea. But once I went in that little studio, I was absolutely hooked. And all I wanted to do was just be a full-time radio presenter and move onwards and upwards. And yeah, I mean, very, very young and naive age. I'd love to have gone on to, you know, the Capital Radio of the past with those big names, but to have a good career. So my whole, you know, I served as an electronic and electrical apprentice many years ago, and I spent 4 years in apprenticeship, got a qualification, and a further 2 years in the industry to find out that I really was a rubbish engineer. And I really need to go and do something else. And just kind of like everything collided at the same time. The radio authority was saying, Chiltern Radio, you need to have more local programming, otherwise we're not going to renew your licence. So all of a sudden there were lots of opportunities for someone like me to get in. And coupled with the fact that I did know, you know, Paul Chandler, I worked with him at Southern Sound, so Steve Power as well, that I had that opportunity to get in. But no, my mind was solely on being a radio presenter.
And who were the people that you listened to and thought, wow, I want to be them? Or maybe you wanted to be yourself, but who were the people who influenced you?
That's a really, really interesting question, because I'd like to break that down into two areas. There are people who influenced my career, and those that I just think were just totally amazing. So I'm going to say his name again. If he's listening, sorry, mate. Steve Power, radio hero and friend. He influenced me. Chris Copsey. At Southern Sound, Southern FM. Amazing, amazing presenter who influenced me. There were others at Chiltern Radio that I thought were, you know, really, really good, that, again, professionally they influenced me and sort of, in my own mind, kind of like helped develop me into the sort of radio presenter I wanted to be. And I have a very early 90s kind of sound, you know, that was my era. In terms of those radio presenters that I would add to that list as great influencers, Richard Allenson, who I just think, when he was on Capital in particular, but also when he was on Radio 2, he was a breath of fresh air on those late shows. He was absolutely brilliant. Then he did the Wall of Sound on a Saturday afternoon, and he was just so, so good. So he's very much up there. The one that I had an opportunity, in fact, I did have an opportunity, I did work with Neil Fox just on an evening in a nightclub in Gloucester when he was the replacement for David Jensen on the network chart. And it became, not the Nescafe, I think it's the Pepsi network chart. And he was brilliant, an absolute gentleman, and really enjoyed working with him. And if you look at some of the major names, yes, you know, you look at all the sort of Radio 1 DJs of old that were absolutely brilliant. But for me, the ultimate one-to-one radio presenter, Terry Wogan. You could not listen to someone who ever, I don't think, who connected on a personal level to the listener like Terry Wogan. He was the goat, I believe they call him these days, the daddy, you know. He was just absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, he was quite an influence as well.
Yeah, because I remember when Wogan returned to The Breakfast Show in 93. So I was a bit too young to remember his first incarnation. But over on Radio 1, around that time, you had Adrian John with the early show. You had Mike Reed. Mm. And what I loved about those presenters is that you knew that it wasn't scripted. You knew that, as with Wogan, of course, famously, that there was I think it may have been in Jeremy Vine's autobiography, but Wogan was in the lift at 7:28 or even 7:29 in the morning, and Jeremy Vine was not on till midday, and Wogan said, it's all right, no, you're first, you know, you go where you need to go. And he said, but you're on the radio in a minute. He said, yeah, it's fine, you know, I'm experienced in this, I know what I'm doing. And so he literally walked into the studio and did his show off the cuff. And that always appealed, because, and Ed Stewart, another presenter, when they're doing it live, you really felt the connection, the need to connect. And also you just knew that it was live. On the rare occasions when they didn't do it live, you knew it. During lockdown, Tony Blackburn, what I would say the greatest sort of, he's what, 81 now, unbelievably good broadcaster. But during lockdown, he had to pre-record all his shows. And you could tell. And you could tell that he wasn't enjoying it because he was having to do the very thing that was, if you like, the antithesis of what made him such a great presenter. And so that sort of liveliness. And you're right, doing someone like Wogan Breakfast, we all remember him from his chat show, and that was great. But there was something about Wogan on the radio which was almost a very different, very more comfortable persona.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's... You just knew what you were going to get in terms of his humour, in terms of his style, his approach, his warmth. Absolutely amazing. And also, I think his attitude, and you hit upon a story there from Jeremy Vine. I recall now, and forgive me to those that I mention if I've got this a little bit wrong, but when Chris Evans was Radio 1, and I think, if the story goes, Chris and Terry had... we're going to play a round of golf. And it got to sort of like late afternoon, early evening. And Chris says, oh, I've got to go now because I've got to go and prepare the show for tomorrow morning. And Terry Wogan looked at him and he says, Chris, let me give you one piece of advice. They either like you or they don't. And I just thought, do you know what, that's amazing. I mean, with a show like mine, the analogue is, I do put in a lot of preparation. A two-hour show takes 4 hours to actually... research and plan and produce and the like, and you hope that people like it. But with that sort of presenter and his experience, but also the way that he's so relaxed about it, and not arrogant, he was never arrogant, but is so relaxed about, well, do you know, this is me, I really hope you enjoy it. Well, I mean, that just speaks volumes for the man.
Yeah, and I remember when Chris Evans took over on the Radio 2 Breakfast Show. And for 2 weeks, he pre-recorded. So he didn't pre-record. He did the rehearsal. So it meant that the regular travel presenter was not on air because they were doing it, and Moira Stewart was in, and they were doing it as if live. And I think to the presenters who were, Johnny Walker was covering, I think it was almost a sort of like, well, this is strange, but okay, he's a great broadcaster, let him do what he has to do. But for me, my fear would be I would do those pre-records and they might be better than anything I would do live. Or rather, doing it live, you could never rehearse what you're doing. That doesn't mean to say that you can't do brilliant, but I mean, when I first met you, I know that the Analog Years is on twice on the weekend, but I was thinking, I genuinely didn't know whether it was live or not to listen to, which is also a great compliment. But that is the difference, I think, that sometimes when you're doing a live show, there is just something in the air, something which is a slice of life. It's in the moment and you're never going to recapture it.
And also it's an edge. It is an edge. And you know that when you open that microphone, what comes out will go live. And if you mess it up, you mess it up. If it's a brilliant link and you've done a jock it up to the vocal and you've hit it absolutely beautifully, right speed, right tempo, it's brilliant. It's a great feeling. Whereas when I record the Analog Years, believe me, not always, but there is some editing. If I mess it up royally, then I just start again on the section. So it's recorded over 2 hours. There's three sections per hour. And if I really mess it up, I just go, do you know what? I'm going to do this again. Yeah. Or I will leave it for a day. So the Analog Years, I present it as live, but it isn't live. But I still get that same kind of edginess by presenting it as live, because I know it goes out in Cabinet, it goes out on various other radio stations through agesradio.com, and it's nice to do it as live, and I think that's the edge.
Yeah, I agree, because there was one show, and of course it's the inevitable thing because we're giving away the secrets of the trade here, but when on Cabin, of course, if the person in the studio before has been pre-recorded or if you're not paying close enough attention, you might forget that suddenly a pre-recorded weather bulletin will come on, and you open your mouth to speak, and suddenly there's two voices, and you're like, hang on, what's going on here? And there's a part of me that thinks, no, this is so unprofessional, or suddenly pressing the button too early, or you click it twice because the record doesn't come on, and then you get the news 3 minutes to the hour, you know, the sort of thing that would make me mortified. However, listening back, or people have said, I love that, the way that you handled it, and I was thinking, what, I was just panicking. but I suppose, or somebody walks into the studio And then suddenly you put them live on air and you're thinking, this is great because it's live. And that's the whole point. Was once upon a time, I'd have panicked, not panicked, that's the wrong word. I would have thought, oh, I've got this show all beautifully set out. Somebody's come into the studio. It's scuppering it. Opposite is the case. You bring them in, you invite them on, and you have an impromptu chat, and that proves that it's live. Now, in a way, it's early days for me, but there is something that I'm trying to recapture, and the stories that you're telling are brilliant because they kind of match. Obviously, people like Richard Allenson, who's obviously I'm very familiar with his presenting, but there's something in there about how, I mean, these days, you can listen back to the shows because on various catch-up facilities, maybe on Cabin, not yet, but there is something about what you can capture that kind of, it's in the moment, you're not going to get it back. I joked before we started recording that when I used to listen to the charts on a Sunday growing up, then I was the person who wouldn't tape the music and then try to stop the recording before the presenter, Tony Blackburn or Tommy Vance, whoever, started speaking. I wanted to capture the presenters because that was the bit that was real and live and spontaneous, and you'd never get it again. The music, pre-existed. So in a way, I think I've always been lateral. I've always done things the opposite way to most people. And for me, radio is not about the music. It should be. It is the music, but it's the music complemented by something that is saying to people, whatever mood they're in, hello, we're here for you.
And it's connection. It is always about connection with radio, about having that as much as you can, a one-to-one style. And even if it's laced with the sort of stereotypical being a bit of a radio presenter, DJ, actually, are you a friendly voice at the end of a microphone, speaking to someone, playing music that you like and you want to play? And there's nothing better, I think. It's that connection is really very, very important. And don't underestimate as well, I think, the power of the radio presenter. And I think this is one of the things over the years we have lost. And this is a personal view, and I'm sure that there's many elderly radio presenters like myself who are going to go, yes, David, you said the right thing. There's far too many superstars coming onto radio now. There's not the radio presenter. And some of them are really, really good. I mean, I'll give you one example. Ronan Keating. Yeah. Brilliant. He's a really very, very good radio presenter. Kerris Matthews. As now, Kerris, absolutely unbelievable. But there are others, I'm certainly not going to sully any names at all, but there are others that have sort of got on the radio because they're either superstars or they are sons and daughters of superstars, and, we'll have them on, they seem to be all right, and they'll be popular, which is a bit of a shame, but it meets a need. It meets a need.
Yeah, and sometimes that they are popular for other reasons. And my sense is that they're often, and I always find it interesting, they're bookended by presenters. I won't tell you what Johnny Walker said, but it's just interesting that it was 2009. It was around the time Wogan was about to end his breakfast show. And there were some interesting reflections on the radio, the way radio was moving. And here was somebody who was a pirate DJ. And he, of course, to this day, because he's very ill at the moment, but he's still on Radio 2, but was just aware of those trends and was actually literally bookended by presenters who came from a very different kind of ethos.
Yeah. And, evolution and change is a natural part of any business, whether it's radio or anything else, really. I just think, and speaking personally, I just think that the pendulum in some areas has swung the wrong way a little bit too far. The other interesting things which we were talking about as well, and I spoke to a wonderful, wonderful guy called David Ty, who I work with at Seven Sound, and he's been in senior management in radio. He's now chief executive of a charity over in Ireland. Terrific guy, really experienced and brilliant broadcaster. And I was saying to him, hasn't this landscape changed so much? And he said, yeah, he said, because you don't just submit some sort of recording, like in the years ago it was a cassette, now some sort of MP3 file or, whatever. It's the presence you bring as well, the online presence. So a lot of radio groups will say, what's your online presence? How many followers have you got? What are they liking about you? They're asking some wider interest questions that one could say overshadow the radio bit, or is it a case that radio is part of that package? And it just so happens that someone famous will have a great online presence, good podcast presence, good social media presence. And the fact that they're on the radio is great because it's a win-win. On the radio, they're associated with a big radio station. And likewise, the big radio station are associated with the personality with their social media presence. Is it a bad thing? Is it a good thing? Well, dear listener, you decide yourself. But I just would hate to think that the real kind of, I think, original, you know, or retro kind of sound of radio would be lost one day. And that would be a sad thing, in my view.
And as somebody, as you clearly are, who has worked with those very people or met those people who were your, you know, radio heroes, the people you grew up with or you met them and admired their work, is there that sort of disconnect between what the... Because Jeremy Vine's autobiography was brilliant at encapsulating one thing, which is that the listeners associate a radio station with the presenters, you know, Terry Wogan or himself. But in the industry, it's the producers, it's the people behind the scenes who make it work, that the people who are on air are not the people with the power. When they're on the radio, that they have the currency, but effectively they don't get to choose whether their show's going to be given another season, and that it's the people in the background. And of course, that's what happened with Radio 1 when Matthew Bannister took over in the 90s. Mm. It was very obvious, and it seeped into, you know, what was said on air. Effectively, presenters, we don't need to mention who they were, effectively said, I don't like the way management is moving, and it's against my principles. And of course, then we know what happened.
Yeah.
very well, yes. But there was something, but although Smashy and Nicey at least acknowledged and were, they did a lot of those older presenters a lot of good, because those who were in, most of them were in on this, and they got it and they understood where they belonged, and it was very affectionate, but it was the brutality, of course, that happened in the real radio world, and something, and the you know, the whole Garden of Eden thing, but the innocence was lost around that sort of 1993-94 period.
I'd introduce a couple of more comments on that. I think one is brand, and with brand comes style, approach, culture, what's your strategic objective, what are you trying to do? And that's where commercial radio was really hitting Radio 1 really, really hard, I think. Not just because I think, you know, you had what was appeared to be, you know, a throwback to a different time, and there was a need for modernisation in terms of the approach. But what was the brand? And I think, you know, fair play to a lot of radio groups, they were getting it right. With that, is it really the presenters that are making the station, or are the presenters complementing the station? With Radio 1, Radio 2, and with some pirate radio stations, like Radio Caroline, brilliant Radio Caroline, love Radio Caroline, you get the personalities that are within the sort of station's overall output, but there are some key differences. So Jeremy Vine is a very different presenter, and the style of the show was very different to Steve Wright, God bless him, who was an absolute radio legend, which was very different to Johnny Walker, which is very different to Tony Blackburn. They all sort of came together on Radio 2, and it was kind of, yeah, it kind of worked. There was a good, I think, a BBC promo many years ago where they highlighted the differences that actually made the sound of a radio station. You look at Heart, it's very different. Apart from the big personalities, say, at Breakfast and the like, it's actually a very, very similar sound, where the presenter fits in with the style rather than the presenter being the style. The other thing, and I remember being at a reunion, a Southern Sound, Southern FM reunion some years ago, and met the... we seem to be talking about dead people all the time. The late Jeremy Scott, brilliant programme controller of his time, and he was saying, you know, shelf life is one of those things. When you're a radio presenter, and I thought, you know, this is a really wise comment, shelf life. There are very, very few presenters that don't have a shelf life. Many, many do. I had a shelf life. I remember that, looking back on it. I definitely had a shelf life, and I've gone to do lots of other interesting things. But the whole approach to the brand is now, I think, much more critical in terms of the overall sound, which was started, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s, with brands like the Hot FM, Super Gold, with Better Music Mix and things like that. It was a brand. And I think it was presenters had to sort of go around that brand and be part of it rather than being presenters in their own right.
Yeah. And do you find, or did you discover, that you were aware that, you know, your perception was that you no longer hit a particular mark that either you set yourself or you just kind of felt that the movement of travel was such that, you know, your shelf life was limited? Or was it something that, you know, you sort of retrospectively sort of realised? Was it because it must be hard in any job, particularly if you're enjoying it and you want to do it and you feel as excited and energised as ever, that something, you know, it's going to end at some point and maybe soon and, you know, hopefully not too brutally?
Well, my demise was very brutal. I came off air on the Friday a week before the bank holiday weekend in August in 1995, from doing the breakfast show at Seven Sound, and half an hour later I no longer work for the company. And I was 25, and it was brutal. GWR had come and taken over Chilton. I was clearly a name and a personality that didn't fit. I'd had my run-ins. I was very, very ego-driven, and I recognise that. And I look back, whilst I still believe that I was very hard done by in certain areas, other aspects of it, I think I didn't do myself too many favours. And those that who are listening who do know me may appreciate that. So that was really brutal. What compounded the fact that I gave it all up and that was DJing the whole lot by 2000, because I was out doing clubs and discos and pubs and whatever, and a bit of swing presentation, was that after a really difficult year of living in Gloucestershire, but travelling to Brighton to do Saturday and Sundays, and I had to stay with my parents in Crawley. Before that, I had to go to Bedford because they were offering me some Sunday morning breakfast shows, and I had to get up at 3:30 in the morning. And then when I was reduced down to one show on Southern FM, I said, I can't do it. I just can't afford it. But I got a six-month contract at Galaxy 101 to present the weekend breakfast show. Plus, I had a new full-time job and a new career in facilities management in the nuclear industry. And a very, very odd sort of change. That's a story in itself. You know, I kept getting pushbacks. So a good example, a couple of good examples which happened to me. I was due to re-sign my six-month contract, and I went down to Bristol and at Galaxy to be told, oh, sorry, senior management had a change of heart, we're not signing you. You know, I travelled all the way down there. I thought, couldn't you do this over the phone? And I was kind of like, well, where does that leave me? Well, we'll give you some overnight work. I was thinking, oh, okay, I don't really want to do overnights. You know, I've done years of being frontline presenter, and I did some swing shifts for them. I also remember just missing out on opportunities. And I just thought to myself, someone's trying to tell me something here. So I had some bad experiences just general DJing with people that I knew, and just felt that I was taken a little bit for a ride, wasn't earning any particular money, and my career path was changing radically. I was being educated, trained, and an opportunity in my current career of emergency, disaster management, business continuity and things like that was really blossoming. And I had new objectives, new goals. But it was really hard because I had a breakdown at 25, and because of all of this. So I was not prepared for what happened to me, not at all. But it was the biggest life lesson I've ever had.
Yeah, and when you mentioned what you're doing now, and you mentioned the nuclear industry, and of course I also know from experience just how brilliant you were when we moved location at Cabin. And I'm somebody who can do the basic stuff when I'm on air. I know how to switch the microphone on and off, but you were actually moving an entire studio. So you brought a completely a level of technical expertise to
us. Well, I think so can I plug now? So I run my own little business called Foresight Solutions, which is foresightsolutions.net, which is a company that is dedicated to business resilience, emergency disaster management, crisis management, continuity planning, as well as broader business planning, resilient business planning, which I love. I've done it for the last 25 years. My strengths are about management and leadership and organisation at a time of need. So in any emergency, there are two things that you have a complete lack of. One is control, another one is time. So what I do is I do a lot of work with a range of organisations to identify what's critical to them and to identify how do we protect it, how do we continue, how do we be resilient as an organisation, and how do we respond. And that brings in a whole range of different skills. Now, my radio presentation skills and voice and whatever really does help, particularly for training. But it also helps me in the field of emergency management, command and coordination. So what I like to think I bring to Cabin is a good organisational head. The technical head is definitely Damon Oldacre, who's unbelievable at all of this. What I do is I just try and bring a sense of leadership in the organisation, and I'm the charity's secretary as well. So I do more work away from the microphone than I do in front of it, and I get equally as much enjoyment.
And this is where life experience comes in, because it sounds, and the irony is that we're about the same age, there's only a few years between us, but you were doing in your early 20s what I wanted to do or imagined that I would be doing in my early 20s, you know, back when I was 7 and 8 and listening to those charts on a Sunday evening and so on. And then in your case, obviously, that went the way that it did, but there's a life beyond that where you haven't actually given up the radio. It's just that you're doing it in a way that is much more balanced in terms of what it is that you want to do. You bring another sort of level of skills. It's interesting, isn't it, that whole thing about any job. I've been in the same profession since the age of 18, but always aware that there was something else I needed or wanted to do, and it's finding that middle ground between the skills from one area, bring it into another. And it's funny you mentioned the Foresight Solutions, because of course that's the thing that, you know, when I'm about to read the weather and that comes on, and I'm like, here we go, and it's fantastic, and that gives me the real sense of urgency, probably exactly what you're looking for, when I start my show.
Well, that's good, that, you know, and if I do that, then thank you, it's an absolute pleasure. I think you know, why did I get into Cabin? Well, that's Steve Ralph, who's one of our volunteers that I met whilst, I have to say, under the influence. And he kind of said, look, you know, you'll be really, really great. And I was kind of thinking when I moved to Herne Bay, well, what else could I do? And I thought to myself, do you know what? I'd love to do a pre-recorded show again. So I came up with the Analog Years, and I haven't looked back. It's on about 25 stations around the world, which is really nice. But Steve kind of got me back into a radio station locally. But what I wanted to do was just add my own kind of, not necessarily radio experience or presentation experience, although it's nice to know it's appreciated. It's what else I bring as a human being in terms of my professional skills, in terms of my personal attributes. Because at the end of the day, you're doing it for free. The where I am enormously fortunate, and whilst I did go through a very, very bad time in my mid-20s, actually, as always, you learn from these shocking falls in life, and a big fall from grace for me. I really hurt. I look back on it now, and I know it's a bit of a cliche, but was it one of the best things that could have happened to me? Yeah, I think there's a very solid argument to say that. Did it motivate me to do something else? Not initially, but when I did turn my attention to doing something else, I found out I was really good at it and I really enjoyed it. And of course, every career has ups and downs. Getting to a stage of life now where, you know, I'm not ready to retire, but, you know, you're thinking about it in sort of like, you know, 5 to 10 years time, you know, when am I going to retire? this is a really golden age of doing this sort of thing. Radio, podcasting, you know, being involved in a charity, being involved in a local community, listening to seagulls up here, as you may have heard in the background. It's just a wonderful kind of crescendo at the moment, a really good wave that I'm riding at the moment of enjoyment,
yeah,
and satisfaction. And I think if you can't get that in whatever you do, think about doing something else.
I think that's right, because I was going to ask that very question about the way that we're defined by other people, because at the end of the day, you might have this idea about the sort of person that you are and the job that you're doing. And in my own former profession, it was almost laughable that there were some people who were complaining that there was a movement of travel, which you kind of thought, well, yeah, but you know, you're beholden to a paradigm that may have existed 20 or even 30 years ago. But it's almost that, you know, it used to be quite funny when you'd have some people who'd have big arguments about how we don't want students to submit essays electronically. We like to sit by a fire roasting in the background and mark these essays with a pen and paper. And at the time I was thinking, that's a world that doesn't exist anymore. No. And you're fighting for something that even I don't believe in, you know, and I was a lot younger than some of the people who were saying that.
But people do believe in it. People do believe in it. And I think, you know, to sort of tie the points that you're making together, I think, you know, as I've got older, and this is a point I think that was raised by in a book from Jeremy Paxman, I think it was in his autobiography, wonderful journalist and presenter, and of course University Challenge guru, and he, I can't remember what the exact words were, but you know what he suggested, that in life, when you're younger, things are so important, aren't they? And if that can drive that paradigm in one's own mind, and as you get older, the vivid colours of youth become much more pastel. And I'm really happy about that, because I was so ego driven back then. You know, some may say I'm very ego-driven now. I don't think I am. I just enjoy what I do. But the ability to sit back, and I think emergency management allows you to do that, sit back and actually say, right, what are my options here? What do I absolutely need to do? And, you know, what can I let go? And, you know, what can sit on one side? It's not a bad skill to have in life, just to take that kind of rain check and step back and say, do I want to do more radio, or do I want to do something else, or do I want to combine some things? And I'm just in that, you know, really fortunate position where I work for myself, and I've got some great clients. I'm paying the bills, no problem whatsoever. And I'm doing a couple of voluntary things, Cabin FM, and volunteering as well at Herne Bay Football Club. And just really enjoying it.
Yeah, and something I always ask in the podcast is, with that nostalgia vibe, and you've already answered this really, about whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. Because, I mean, referring to my previous profession, you know, obviously it's easy to look back and say, oh, it was fine, it worked well. And, you know, you forget sometimes that in order to do what you're doing and be good at it, you have to have encountered obstacles. Now, there are different degrees of that, because there's the obstacle when you press the wrong button on the deck and, you know, learn from it. And then there's the bigger obstacle when you're made redundant or you're fired in the most diabolical way. And you suddenly have to ask the question, well, what do I do from this point on? You know, it's not going the way it's supposed to. And then there's the whole mental health element as well of, you know, this is my lifestyle, this is me. And it's as though somebody's just said, you know, sorry, we don't like that direction of travel. And I always find that sometimes, maybe even when you're going through something, you never know if you're going to survive it or you're going to come out of it the other side. I've been in this position in a very personal way. I mean, I was off the radar for a few years, not in a, you know, I was teaching my students, but I had zero presence in any other capacity. And you look back and think, well, yeah, I now have a story to tell, a good story to tell. Doesn't make it okay. You don't then look and say, oh, I'm glad I went through that hell. But actually in doing that, you feel that there's something you have to do with it. There has to be, if you can turn it into something creative, even if it's just telling a story so that other people might hear it and say, okay, thank you. You've connected with me. You've shared, you know, you've proven that there is life on the other side. Then there's some good in it. But at the time, you may not see it that way. But is that something, looking back, that kind of makes sense for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you use the word nostalgia. For nostalgia always seems to have a very happy note about it. It's something that makes you feel good or feel proud or enables you to sort of look back at, you know, what were not necessarily better times, but there was certainly a degree of it being very, very positive. Would I say I'm particularly nostalgic? I'm nostalgic when it comes down to my radio work. Way, way back in the late 80s, early 90s, I'm very nostalgic about that. And I really had an amazing time as a young lad growing up. And that was really, really good. Where it got difficult was towards the end of my full-time career. And I don't use nostalgia to look back on. I use reflection. And reflection allows you to critically think, what happened, why did it happen, what were the outputs, and what did you do and or learn from it? And I think that's a very, very different beast. I'm a combination of both. So nostalgia, I think, is the positive side. Reflection is the not-so-positive side, but both are absolutely essential for one to push forward.
Yeah, and that's really well put, because the nostalgia can also have that, you know, it's the bitter and the sweet. There is something ingrained in it that it's not there now. When I started doing my podcast and work on nostalgia, I was thinking, you know, nostalgia is synonymous with the past. Then I realised it's actually a lack now, that it's something, it's filling a gap. It's almost like, oh, why aren't things the way they were? I've got to ask you, actually, whether you have those recordings. You know, when you mentioned that you're nostalgic, or you can be nostalgic about the radio shows from the 80s, do they exist?
I've got some old cassettes somewhere. In this, because we're seated, dear listener, in my little office where I produce the analog gears and do my work and just generally spend about 90% of my time. I'm sure there are some cassettes in there, but I don't go back and listen to them. I do pick up the sort of like the nostalgia feeds and, you know, posts and whatever, and you see some interesting photos. So I think, oh God, I remember that chap. He had a lot more hair than he has now, and a lot darker. But I don't sort of deliberately go back and listen to myself when I had probably a squeakier voice. But I do reflect if you sort of get nostalgic about the good times that I had. But I also reflect on the whole experience and how it impacted me. And I don't dwell on it, but I do reflect on it to say those were very untidy threads in one's tapestry of life. But I'm not going to pull at them anymore.
Yeah, and often there's that urge, isn't there, to try and process, to make sense of something. Otherwise we go mad. You know, it's almost that sense of, okay, I can't make sense. It's a jigsaw. It's the jigsaw puzzle analogy, or somebody writing an essay or a thesis or something, which is a way of bringing together disparate elements and trying to make sense of it in a way that perhaps somebody else would do a very different job with the same components.
Yeah, but also I think there is an element, whether it's, you know, whether you reflect on nostalgia or reflect on any experience, or use nostalgia to sort of create those sort of happy memories, or however you really want to put it. I remember when I first got diagnosed with mental health issues, and I'm a middle-aged man. I suffer from depression, mild depression, like most guys. I'm quite happy to admit it. I hope, you know, other guys admit it, because it is a really important health issue. But I remember going to see my GP in Gloucestershire, and he said, look, you know, people where you used to work have dealt you some very bad cards, and they have been horrible to you. And I expect you want to do all sorts of really nasty things to them and write to the papers and do all of this. And he said, you know what, you've got to find a box in your life, and that box you need to put into are all those things that you'd like to do to those people. And I don't, you know, mean in a particularly, you know, seditious or nasty way, but, you know, you want to get a bit of revenge. And you pop it in that box, and what you live with is the fact that that'll never happen. And it was one of the best pieces of advice that I've ever been given.
And that really resonates with me as somebody who keeps a diary, because I have stuff. you know, and I don't, actually, funny enough, when I'm on air, I sometimes, in a far more upbeat way, because I will obviously, I'm not going to be reading out all the sort of, you know, the horrible stuff from 20 years ago, but I'm aware that I have a record. It's almost, it's maybe it's a corroboration, maybe it's a need sometimes to sort of know who you are, who one is, because it's there, because it's easy to gloss over or sometimes even genuinely forget that something happened. And on a very factual level, sometimes somebody might say, oh, that didn't happen, or, you know, and you're thinking, I know, you know, it's like, you know, am I losing my mind? And you've got some sort of corroboration from the period. But there's also a sense sometimes of what to do with that, because when you're on radio, you're disseminating, you're broadcasting, you're sharing. But you know, I'm not stupid enough to know that there are some things that would be highly inappropriate to share. You've got to know the right context. But sometimes, you know, when I was moved, funny, when I first met you, on when we were about to move into the new studio, not in, you know, exactly where, from where we're now broadcasting, I wasn't able to join you at the pub. I had to go back and clear up my office, because I moved from my office on the day that you moved from cabin. And I was going to this file, and I came across stuff that was literally 20 odd years old. And it was like minutes of a staff meeting, and it was stuff. And it was some deeply personal stuff, the stuff that you think, you know, nobody at the time could have imagined that 20 years on, that would still be there. You know, they'd be embarrassed that it was there. And I was like, what do I do with this? You know, and it's interesting, because it suddenly makes you rethink not just who you were, but how others may have seen you. And I remember just sitting in a chair and just thought, where is my, you know, what is the direction of travel from this point? I was literally about to leave an office and leave a job that I've been doing for 20 years while doing all the presenting on Cabin, and just suddenly thinking, my goodness me, you know, those, thank goodness I'm not living in that world anymore. But it's a world that feels both close and distant at the same time.
Yeah, and I think it's how you package that. You know, and I think counselling is obviously, I mean, I went through extensive counselling, and actually put it into those different boxes. So there's been people that have been horrible to me, you'd love to get your revenge, but you know what, it's never going to happen. Pop it in that box, and actually, how do you deal with that in terms of your feelings, and how do you reflect and move on positively? There are other things, the nostalgic box or nostalgia box. You package that. And there are various other boxes that you want to sort of package those things in. I've been very, very fortunate that, you know, throughout my career, you know, post-radio, I have managed to not climb back into those boxes that have pain in them too often. And actually to create new boxes and create new memories and to create something as positive as it can be in your life at that time. And, you know, reflecting on that career, you know, where it's taken me from, you know, quite frankly, a very ego-driven idiot at times, to where I am now, where I am super comfortable with myself. Super comfortable, love what I do, have, you know, a wonderful partner, I have a wonderful home, I have a wonderful life, I do some really enjoyable things. It's not, you know, there are people a lot worse out there.
Yeah, and it's that filter, because we'll wrap up in a minute, but I think you've hit the nail on the head, and that's for me why maybe radio is a form of confessional, a form of therapy, both for the listeners and the presenter, because I might be looking through some old entries, because I do this sort of on this day in history thing. What was I doing on this day in 1995 or whatever? And sometimes I'm thinking, oh my goodness, but I'm having to filter it, because I know what I can and should say and what I will say, and you know what I shouldn't say. And in doing that, I think, well, yeah, it means that I've got a good sense of control and a good filter, which means that I may sometimes be morose. I might go down a path sometimes when I feel, and maybe I'll come off air and suddenly all those sort of those demons that have come back, but you know that there's 3 hours which are glorious, which are blessed, because you get to do what you want to do on your own terms. And there's that old Woody Allen adage, isn't it? Say, if only life could be like this, you know. So the answer is probably do more radio. But I got one more question, David, as we start to wrap up, which is, would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Ooh, excellent question, sir. Excellent question. I think it depends in what which context. In general, if I was to answer that as a one or the other, a binary answer, looking forward, definitely. I'm much more looking forward. I think they're just in everybody's life, there are far too many people who want to drag you back to a particular time or have a particular view that it was better back then, or, you know, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Well, do you know what? It's in the past. And you can shape a future. You can't shape a past. So I am more instinctively looking forward. Where I think it is important to look back, as I said earlier in this podcast, is about reflection and using that to help drive that view forward and to try and learn from it and to be influenced by it, but not let it overly influence you. And I think, you know, coming back into radio is a really good example whereby I met Steve Ralph, and he said, you know, would you like to join? And I thought, yeah, do you know what? I will do. But what I didn't look back on was all the stuff that I'd done before in full-time and part-time radio. And I didn't let the negativity of how it ended and the negativity of the life I had to lead for 2 years after being, you know, sacked, pretty much, you know, I was sacked. My contract was terminated and I was given an extra month's money and politely told to go away. So that's not driving me in terms of what I do for Cabin and what I do for the Analog Years and Ages Radio. It's you know, that is a life experience rather than a broadcast experience. And actually what I wanted to do, and I think one of the great things, I don't get paid for it, is contribute in my own way. And if I do that and it makes people smile, then I've done a good job.
You couldn't have put that more, I mean, that's a great role model as well, isn't it? Because it shows you're somebody who has within you a clear sense of what you can contribute. But the fact that it's voluntary as well means that you can shape it, because you're doing this because you want to do it and need to do it. You're not doing it because you're going against your principles, or, you know, it's not an integrity issue.
It's good fun. And I think in whatever you do, whether it's paid or unpaid, does it fulfil you? And I think that's a really important question. Yes, bills have got to be paid. You know, I have two imaginary cats here in the house that need feeding. Yes, I'd like a couple of cats in years to come. The mortgage needs to be paid, et cetera, et cetera. And you've got to find a way to do that. But I've been so fortunate in the way that I do that, coupled with sort of the voluntary aspects and things that I really want to do with Cabin and Herne Bay FC and the like, and one or two other things as well. It's great. And, you know, I know that you drive, your podcast is driven by nostalgia. Nostalgia is a part of that, definitely, which drives me forward. But I think reflection as well is a really important tool.
David, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
You're very welcome.